Well, good evening. I've been asked to come here and speak about the next story, but I don't want to talk about my book. That would be very self-serving. What I want to talk about is the next story as more of a series of ideas, something that's been bouncing around in my mind for really the last few years that eventually worked their way into a book, but something that was very important to me for a number of months, a number of years really. I started thinking about this world that we live in, this strange new Facebook, email, cell phone, Twitter, blogging, internet, computer, iPod, iPad world that we're all part of, and I just started thinking about, I don't know how to live in this world. This is a new world to me. I'm not very old, but this is still a very new world to me. And I started thinking about, how do we live as Christians in this world? Maybe we're living as Christians in the last world, and we haven't yet transitioned to thinking about this world in a distinctly Christian way. Well, Jesus told us to live as Christians in this world, but he did that in a very different context, a very, very different time and place. And in the last 2,000 years, the world has been transformed again and again, and it's been transformed very often by technological innovations, by technology, whether we're talking printing press or we're talking computers. It's often technology that drives the change. In our day, we're in the midst of a new transformation. It's a digital transformation, and it affects all of us, and it affects me. I was born in the 70s. Just before personal computers began to make their way into our homes. It affects my parents, people who were born in the, 40s or 50s. And they are now, they were born in that world, but now they carry cell phones with them all the time. They have email addresses. They're on Facebook. So they're part of this world. And it affects my son. He just turned 11 years old. He's been born into a world where he never knows anything except computers all the time. Everywhere he goes, there are computers. He can't imagine life without computers. And so we're talking about this new world, we're talking about this next story, the story that involves all of us on some level. So here is my challenge. How do I take 2 years of study and a stack of books? I've read many books on this. It was about 7 feet high, I think, when I put it all together, and then a 200-page book I wrote. How do I compress that down into about 20 minutes here? That was a challenge. Obviously, I can't do that. So what I wanted to do was just give you one big takeaway. I thought, I've got a few minutes. I can give one big takeaway here. The one thing that stood out to me more than anything else in the writing and the preparation of this book. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'd like to do it by way of just a few little vignettes, just a few descriptions of this world we live in, things you'll be able to identify with, I think. What we're facing here in this world in the 21st century is something that's entirely new. Nobody else in all of history has had to deal with some of the things that we are dealing with at this digital frontier. No one else has had to think about what it means to have in your pocket at all times a device that can be used to access pretty much all of the world's information at once. This is a new thing. People thought that was science fiction not too long ago, and yet here are our iPhones with direct access to the whole World Wide Web. They're with us all the time. How about the challenge of taking all of our books, every book ever written according to Google, and trying to digitize them and make them available to us? Suddenly billions of books are going to be available to us that have never been available before. What does this do to us? How does this change us and affect us? Again, no one else in all of history has had to think about this. No one else in history has had to think about an encyclopedia where we, you and I, all of us, can edit that encyclopedia. We can build it. And there's nobody there telling us what we can or cannot say. These are new challenges. So here's the one big takeaway I had in writing a book about this intersection between the Christian life and technology, digital technology, and it's this. There is a distinctly Christian way to think about technology. All technology, whether it's printing press or the iPad. And the big implication then is this, is we need to think about our technologies in this distinctly Christian way. If we're to live in this world for God's glory, we need to think as Christians. So let me illustrate this need for technological discernment, if I could, by way of a few vignettes. And we'll start with Laura Ingalls Wilder, a name that I think is probably familiar to most of you. I'm talking about the one in the books, not in the TV show. I was raised as a reader, not as a television watcher. So I'm talking about the real one who wrote books. And for me, Laura always represented a different time and a different age. She was the pioneer girl, right? The consummate pioneer. She represented this innocent age. She was a girl from a different time and a different place. And I loved those books. I wanted to live in her time. They sounded so romantic. And yet, you know what happened? It's interesting, is Laura really came to live in our world. She was born in 1867 in a little log cabin out on the American frontier, just at the end of the Civil War, and just after 2 years after the age of Lincoln came to an end, she was born there in the wilds, on the frontier. She would cross the nation before railroads were built across the way, and so she went across by covered wagon just a few miles a day. She and her family settled on Indian land, what was still Indian land, and they were actually kicked off of that land. She is America's pioneer girl, and people continue to be so interested in her on that basis. But here's the thing. Laura died. Have you ever thought about this? Laura died in 1957. 1957 was the year that the Soviet Union launched a satellite into orbit around the Earth. It was the year that the Boeing 707 took flight, one of the first jet planes, the one that really ushered in the age of jet travel. This was just 4 years before humans orbited the moon. It was just 12 years before America landed a man on the moon. So the pioneer girl died in the space age. You ever thought about that before? In 90 years, the world went from covered wagons to jet planes. It went from steam engines to rockets in just 90 years. And here we are, 55 years later or so after Laura died, and it would take hours and hours, it would take days for us to recount all of the major technological marvels that have come our way even since she died. The pace has not slowed at all, the pace of change, and in fact, I think the pace is actually increasing. We're going now from one thing to the next, to the next in this sort of exponential way. Things are increasing so fast that as soon as we get used to one thing, something else jumps in to take its place. If you think you saw a lot of change, if you think there's a lot of change in her life in those 90 years from the steam engine to the rocket ship, just imagine the child who's born today or the child who was born 10 years ago. Imagine what life will look like by the time that child hits 90 years old. I don't think we'll even recognize this world. So there's our first little vignette, just a little snippet that illustrates the pace of change, the historical pace of change. Let me move to another one. This one's about Encyclopedia Britannica. And when I was a kid, I wanted Encyclopedia Britannica. I was that kind of a kid, I suppose. And you know Britannica, right? That huge 32-volume set. It would stretch from here to here, 32 volumes just packed with information, 65,000 articles about everything, right? 4,000 experts got together to write this thing. And if you wanted to read about the Masters tournament, well, Arnold Palmer was the one who wrote that article. They'd call in experts to write the articles on certain topics. Everything was all thoroughly fact-checked. It was, if Britannica said it was true, it was true. This was a definitive source of information. When I was a kid, yeah, there were other encyclopedia guys who would be selling World Book or something else. I wanted Britannica. This was the Cadillac. This was the one. Well, encyclopedias seem a little bit quaint today, don't they? The encyclopedia salesman hasn't knocked on your door for a long, long time, I suspect. In fact, if you go into Google and you type in Encyclopedia Britannica, what's going to pop up? Wikipedia will be there. And so here we have the new and the old, or the old and the new, as it may be. And it's interesting, if you go into Google and you start typing in theological terms, things that are very, very important to Christians, go in there sometime and type God or baptism, justification, Christianity, salvation, almost all the time your first source of information will be Wikipedia. Now, Wikipedia is an encyclopedia as well, one that was begun in 2001. It's a crowdsourced encyclopedia, an online one. Anyone can add, anyone can edit, anyone can remove. It's wide open to all of us. Britannica had 4,000 editors. Wikipedia has 1 billion or 2 billion or however many use the internet today. Any of us can edit it. Many of us do. It has 15 million articles right now. Britannica had 65,000. Wikipedia has 15 million in 240 languages. And only now are we starting to see that growth level off a little. Still, there's many articles being added every day. Every minute, there's new articles being added. It's consistently one of the most read sites on the internet. Millions of people visit it every day. Two encyclopedias, two very, very different views on authority. Britannica represents the old world, the print world. Experts write the articles, submit them to fact checkers, who submit them to editors. There's this process, defined process of saying, here's what's true, and here's how we will present that truth. Every article is written in the same style. Every article is updated every few years as they bring out a new edition. They update it as events happen. Wikipedia, on the other hand, represents the digital world, the new world. Anyone can write articles. Anyone can edit them. Anyone can fact check them or not fact check them. What is a fact anyways? By whose standard? On whose authority? How do we decide what is true in that online encyclopedia? Well, at the heart of these two encyclopedias is a very important issue. What is right and what is wrong? What is factual and what is fictional? Ultimately, it's an issue of authority. Who has the authority to say this is true and this is false? And on what basis can he make that kind of a judgment? Wikipedia says if we open it up, if we let everybody get involved, then truth will emerge from the consensus. The consensus of all of us is what must be true. If you're Reformed here, if you're a Calvinist and you're thinking total depravity, immediately see a big hole in the middle of that idea. Accuracy comes from consensus? I don't know about that. Britannica says that accuracy is in the realm of the expert. We turn to the experts and they will tell us what's accurate. So which is true? That Wikipedia model, that wiki model, is now spreading. It's gone into dictionaries now. Defining words has become crowdsourced. Even medical knowledge now, a lot of it is crowdsourced. It's even spreading to theology. When it comes to a definition of justification, who do we trust? Who is going to tell us what justification is? Should we leave that out? The group of us together can go online and together we'll come up with a definition. Or do we need experts to help us come to that definition? Do we turn to the theologians, those with training, those who have gone through seminary, those who have studied all the way through PhDs? Who is going to tell us what's true about justification? Today's students no longer go to Britannica, they go to Wikipedia. You and I go to Wikipedia. We can't help it. As soon as we Google something, as soon as we search for it on the internet, there it is, telling us what's right and what's wrong. We've probably heard the old phrase, the medium is the message. That was Marshall McLuhan who coined that phrase. And what he meant to say was that the way we learn things is really as important as what we learn. Now, he overstated his case. He overstated pretty much everything he said. But here's what he was saying. The way we learn is very, very important. And so if we're learning from an old version of an encyclopedia, we're learning from the Britannica model, or we're learning from the Wikipedia model, the way we're learning has every bit as much importance as the information we actually draw out of those sources. So what does Wikipedia tell us? Just in the background, in the back of our minds, what does it tell us about truth and authority? How are you as a Christian thinking biblically about this? How are you as a parent or grandparent helping your children think biblically? A lot of us just say, Wikipedia is nonsense. You don't go there. But this is where people are going. How are we going to help our children? How are we going to help ourselves think about this in a biblical way? So there are two little vignettes. And a moment ago I told you there's a distinctly Christian way to think about technology, any kind of technology. And let me give you just a brief outline of how that, a very brief outline of a theology of technology. And it all begins with God's act of creation, his creation mandate. God created the world and he made us in his image and gave us a mandate to go into the world and to exercise dominion over it. We are to have dominion over all life, to go into the world building families and culture and civilization. This was our mandate, our charge, to rule this world for his glory. And to do that, we would have to rely upon innovation, upon technology, right? We could not do God's mandate, we could not perform his mandate if we didn't invent, if we didn't come up with new ways of exercising dominion over this world. But then sin interfered. Adam and Eve ate of that fruit. They were led astray, and the whole world changed. And suddenly this was no longer a world under our control, but it was a world that fought against us in every way. Everything in the world was subject to the curse, and that includes the things we make. That includes technology. In a perfect world, every invention, every technology would only ever be used for good purposes. We could invent nuclear fission and nothing would ever, ever go wrong with it. Nobody would ever turn it into a bomb and drop it on a city. Nuclear fission isn't an evil technology, but it certainly can be put to evil use. The iPhone in your pocket is not an evil device. Your iPhone isn't evil, but you can sure use it for evil purposes if you're checking email for the 55th time in an evening and ignoring your family, or if you're using it to browse the web looking for pornography. It can be used for evil. So there's a couple things you can think about at this intersection of technology and theology. It's a starting point for that theology of technology. Let me outline it again. Point number one, technology is a good and God-given gift. Technology allows us to imitate God. It allows us to serve God in shaping His creation for good and noble purposes. Number two, technology is subject to the curse. And we need to keep this one in mind. Technology is subject to the curse. So our technology can be used to honor God, or it can be used to compound our rebellion against Him. It can be used to draw our hearts toward God, or it can be used to draw our hearts away from God. And what's remarkable is that it can do both these things in the same use. We can use it in such a way that it'll do two different things. In one way, it'll draw us towards, and in another, it'll draw us away. And so it's how we use technology. It's the way we use it that determines, are we using it for a good purpose? Are we using it for a noble purpose? Are we carrying out God's mandate, or are we destroying God's world? So technology in the big picture is good. We don't have to be Luddites. We don't have to run away from it and just say, oh, that computer stuff is junk. No, we have to live in this world. Technology is good. It is a good thing. And yet we have to use it knowing what we do, that it exists in a fallen world and can just as easily draw us away as toward. So what does this mean? We as Christians need to use technology, and we need to use it well, but always we need to be wary of it. And we tend to just jump on the greatest, the newest and greatest thing. We hear about this new iPad and we just want it so much. We have to be very, very wary of it, trying to understand, what will this do to my life? What is this doing to my heart as I think about this new thing? Let me give you one more little vignette, another snippet from the digital world. And as you think about spiritual realities, think about our near total dedication to screens. Before the mid-1940s, there were really very, very few screens in society, right, in our world. They existed pretty much only in cinemas. You'd go off to the cinema, you'd watch a movie, and that's where you would have a screen. But then television was invented, and screens began to migrate into private homes. In 1946, 0.5% of American households had a single screen in the home. They had a TV screen. Times have changed. Just think about that. For thousands of years, we had no screens whatsoever. Thousands of years of human history, there were no screens at all in the world. And then suddenly, we have, how many screens do you have in your home? 5? 10? Who knows? Between TVs and computers and phones and even your GPS, there are screens all around us. Well, there's a screen up there, and it's interesting to look out and see how many eyes are up there on the screen. We're drawn to screens. We just can't help but look towards them. Think about these statistics. The average daily screen time right now for an 18-year-old is about 8.5 hours a day. The average daily screen time for mom and dad, in case you're feeling proud, is 9.5 hours. So screen time for those 18 and under lacks careful studies at the moment, but I'd be surprised if it was anything less than, say, that 8.5 hours between video games and TV and computer and cell phones and all of these things. People are spending, 8, 9, 10 hours a day looking at screens. Now, about a quarter of that time is combined time, which means you're not just looking at one screen, but you're looking at two. So what you're doing is you're using your computer and watching TV, or you're watching TV and typing a text message on your phone. Time in front of the television screen is still the biggest draw, whether that involves TV, DVD, or some sort of a game. About 5 hours a day for the average 18-year-old. Can you imagine that? 5 hours a day on average for an 18-year-old in front of the TV. Again, lest you get a little bit arrogant here, for mom and dad, it's actually a little bit higher. And what's shocking to me is that though people who are 65 and older are averaging 7.5 hours of TV time a day, which I think is a warning about planning well for your senior years. 7.5 hours a day for those 65 and over of watching television. So these screen averages mean that the average person out here, you're watching on average an hour of commercials every day. Think what that must be doing to people, an hour of commercials every day. Every commercial telling you how you're inadequate and how you need to change, or how your life is inadequate, or your breakfast cereal is inadequate, or something, and how you need to adjust yourself to change. Computer time is about 3 hours a day for an 18-year-old, and quite a bit more for mom and dad, probably because mom and dad have a job that keeps them in front of a screen. And of course, all that time spent on cell phones and sending text messages. A lot of teens now are sending thousands, even tens of thousands of text messages every single month. It's, for many people, it's now the dominant form of communication. It's not unusual to see teenagers sitting in a room typing back and forth on their phones instead of talking to one another. So here we are in about 60 years. We've gone from an average of just over 0 hours a day in front of a screen to hours and hours, 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 or 12 hours a day in front of some kind of a screen, or really in front of a near endless succession of screens. Again, even at this conference, we're watching the speakers up there on the screen, and there are many people at home watching the conference on a screen. These screens are really omnipresent in our lives right now. So much of our life is mediated by a screen. So many of our relationships are mediated by a screen. We've already surpassed the time where we now spend more time in front of a screen than we spend asleep. And we're fast coming up on the time where we spend more of our lives in front of screens than we spend away from them, which would mean, obviously, more than 12 hours a day in front of a screen. We'll have hit this tipping point where our lives are now dominated by the screen. Do you know that a third of women in their 20s and 30s, when they wake up in the morning, before they even go to the bathroom, they check Facebook to see what's been going on overnight? 33% of you out there, if you're in your 20s or 30s, got up this morning and checked in with your social network on Facebook before you even went to the bathroom. Does that sound a little bit like idolatry to you? Does that sound like there's got to be some heart issue there? This isn't unremarkable. There's something going on there that's drawing people on a heart level. It also makes me wonder, what were they doing in that time before Facebook came along? Most people have only been on Facebook for a couple of years. So all those hours they're putting into it, where was it taken from? What were they doing first thing in the morning before they checked in with Facebook? Christian women were reading the Bible and praying. So what does this mean? What does this mean to us as individuals? What does it mean as families, as churches? It must mean something, right? We can't go from a point where there are no screens in our lives and then within 60 years introduce them so that they're a dominant form of media in our life. That has to mean something. But what? Are we prepared? Are we equipped to think through how that changes us? We are shaped by those media. We are shaped by screens. Again, not just by what we see on them, but by the fact that we spend time looking at them. What is that doing to us, and how can we think about it in a Christian way? So there you've got three little vignettes, just three little slices of life here at the 21st century, at the dawn of this new age. And what we as Christians need to know, what we need to understand, what we need to believe, is that we can think about all of this as Christians. We can apply the Bible to all of this. Now, of course, people would say, well, hold on a second. The Bible was written thousands of years ago, and it was written in a day where people didn't even write. It was passed orally from person to person. Then eventually it was written on scrolls, and then it was printed, and now it's heading towards the digital. But what could that book teach me about life with an iPad or life with an email address or Facebook? And yeah, the Bible was written in a very different time and place. It was written at a time when bronze spears and paved roads were near miraculous inventions. It seems very old-fashioned today. But you know what? This doesn't make the Bible irrelevant at all, does it? The fact is, the Bible has this long track record of guiding people from that day, through the print age, through the writing age, now into the digital age. It's that very long time the Bible has been guiding us. It's been giving us biblical wisdom. It's been teaching us how to live in this world. It gives it credibility. The Bible can help us understand how to live in this strange, bizarre new world that we find ourselves in. Again, that Bible was first passed by word of mouth. Eventually it was written, then it was printed. And now many people are experiencing it in the digital. It won't be long before you can't buy a Bible on paper anymore. Maybe another decade or two. Everybody will be reading it on some kind of a device. It'll still be the Word of God. It will still guide us. It will still have the Holy Spirit convicting us through it. In fact, this Bible needs to guide us. We have no choice. We got no choice. There's no going back at this point. We won't ever get rid of all these screens. We won't get rid of the internet. The internet is really just becoming part of who we are. We don't even really think about it anymore. It's just part of our world. It's not going anywhere. We have no choice but to live in this world. The question is, How are we going to live in this world in a way that honors and glorifies and serves God? How are we going to live in this world in a distinctly Christian way? We need to write this next story, and we need to write it for His glory. Thank you.